Recording going. Appreciate Brother Jan carrying the last few of our segments in this overall study of Christian evidences. Of course, as you know, Brother Jan's background is engineering. So last week we got to see a lot about God's engineering of bees' wings and all of those things. My background is biology, of course, medicine, but my undergraduate degree, my bachelor's degree, is in biology, which if I had to make that choice all over again, knowing what I know now, I would not choose that, but because what I ended up getting a degree in is Darwin's theory of evolution. From everything that I studied, from the basic biology and then cell biology and botany and genetics and all of that. It was just nothing but immersion in Darwinian evolution. So I'm not going to try to summarize a four-year college degree and all of that. I wish I had been spared that, but I will spare you that. But this is a subject that is important for us to be familiar with, because we probably already have some familiarity with it, probably not on the level that I had to go through, but if I were to ask for a show of hands of people in here that at some point in your lives have been taught some aspect of Darwin's theory of evolution and had that taught presented to you as if that were actual fact, it might be everybody in this room. I would actually be surprised if it wasn't everybody in this room, even for the little ones among us. Okay, we might have to, I see at least one that I think would not have had it yet, but it's coming. It's coming for him too. So we're all going to be taught this. Our children are going to be taught this. They're already being taught this. And this is the main teaching to contradict and oppose how things truly did come to be, that is the universe and all life, and that is that it was created by God. But the alternative to the truth, to what we know is true, that God created all things, and what the Bible teaches in detail about the creation, what is opposing that, or is the alternative to that, is Darwinian evolution. Of course, that is in reference to Charles Darwin, which we'll get into more here through our time tonight, Lord willing. But before we get into that, just kind of reviewing some things we already are aware of and have seen some in this study. The realm of religion. We know in 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3, I don't have a pointer, so if I need to get my finger, I'll have to lean over the light and tonight, but 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3 tells us that God's word contains all things that pertain to life and godliness. So in the realm of what we need, how we need to live and how we need to please the Creator who made us and put us here, that's what the realm of religion is. That's what the Bible is about. Colossians 1 and verse 9 says that we might be filled with the knowledge of His will and all wisdom and spiritual understanding. So that's what God's Word is teaching us about. And it's focused on the things which are not seen, the eternal things, 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 18. So as part of that, when it comes to the question of the origin of all things, how this universe came to be, how this earth came to be, how life came to be, how we came to be, is that within the realm of what the Scriptures pertain to, about our Creator and who we are and how we need to serve Him? Well, as we've been seeing through the course of this study, this is very elemental, fundamental to our knowing who our Creator is that we need to seek and serve. So the origin of all things is very much within the realm of a religion. That's where the Bible begins, isn't it? I mean, Genesis 1 and verse 1. What is the book of Genesis? What does that mean? It's the book of beginnings. So the very first book of the Bible and the first verse of it, from there all the way through there in the book of Genesis, we have the origin of things that is taught, the truth about it, that the creator of all of it has informed us about. All right, so the realm of science, well, that's the body of knowledge of the physical or material things, the things which are seen, the temporal things. I mean, that's the realm of science, what is in this material world. And we know that God is the author of the Bible, and so therefore he's the source of true religion. He's also the creator of the material universe, and we have its origin discussed in Scripture from the standpoint so we can know who our creator is and that we need to seek and serve him and seek to know his will and do it. But when it comes to science, the origin of the universe, the origin of life, is that really a question of science? It's not. And we'll get into that in more detail here in the next few minutes, Lord willing. Well, starting now. So when it comes to science, and everybody in here, you've all had science classes, and I bet some of our younger ones here have been introduced to the scientific method. Am I right? You've been taught that in school. We all get taught that. If you look it up, I mean, it's organized a little bit differently. It has the same elements in it, no matter how you look at it, but sometimes the terms might be a little bit different. But the scientific method, it's outlined in that little cartoon there. It is the basis of all scientific discovery. And so that method is followed in order to learn about this material world, this universe, to what the things that we can observe. So you observe something, and then you come up with some question about it, a hypothesis, and then you have to set up some experiment to test your hypothesis and to see from that experiment whether that hypothesis is supported or not according to the results or evidence from the experiments that are done. And so then you have to determine whether your hypothesis is correct or not. And then, based upon that, you formulate your conclusions. And this is how we learn things in science. Another aspect of the scientific method that's absolutely fundamental is that of repeatability. In science, if you conduct an experiment and then you publish that and say, I discovered this, I did this experiment, and then everybody goes out there and tries to do the same experiment that you did, but they can't get the same results you got. There have been some people that have claimed to have proven what is cold fusion, which would be, instead of splitting atoms, that would be joining them together and producing energy from that. That has not been able to be done scientifically at this point. There have been some that have rushed out there and said, we've been able to produce cold fusion. And then when people have gone out and tried to follow the methods of their experiments and reproduce the results, they can't. So if the results of an experiment can't be repeated by others, and you say, well, this is what I got, but nobody else can get the same thing doing the same thing, then what happens to those results? Is the conclusion considered to be valid or invalid? Well, that would be an invalid conclusion scientifically. You've got to be able to perform the experiment, get the results, and be able to repeat that. And yourself and anybody else should be able to repeat that and get the same results every time if it's a valid experiment producing that a valid conclusion. Well, what goes along with the scientific method is something that's not listed as one of the parts of the method, but what undergirds it. Well, one of the things is open-mindedness. It's looking for discovery. You come up with a hypothesis. You're not concluding that your hypothesis is right. You're going at it with an open mind to try to set up an experiment to test it, and you're prepared to accept the conclusions from the evidence of your experiment, whether it supports your hypothesis or not. You're going to follow the evidence where it leads. I mean, that's the basis of scientific discovery. Well, that means Scientists, by definition, should be the most open-minded people that there are, in a sense. But is that the case? Well, when it comes to Darwin's evolution, that theory, do we find open-mindedness? How many videos and things, quotes, have we seen from scientists at this point about that have shown that they're anything but open-minded about that subject? Well, that there's much closed-mindedness there. So is that really scientific, or is that anti-scientific? It doesn't fit with science. There are limits to the scientific method. It is limited by what can be observed by the five physical senses, and we'll assume that we all know what those five are. They're listed there if you don't remember. It's also limited to the present time. You can't observe something that's in the past. So if you are doing an experiment and you're observing things and experimenting on it, it's going to be limited to the present time. And to how a process works. Science doesn't answer why it happened, just how it happens. It's also limited to what is amoral. That's not immoral. It means questions of morality are not things that you can deal with in science. You can't test that scientifically. Moral questions, of course, are in God's realm. Also, the scientific method cannot deal with the unique, a one-time occurrence. And so we'll see how that applies to the origin of things. Can the scientific method be applied to a singular historic event? It can't. I mean, none of what human was there to observe the beginning of the universe? Who was there to observe that? How can that be experimented with? That's something beyond the reach of science. Was any human present to observe the origin of life? Nobody was there. None of us were there. Of course, God was there who did it, but that's also out of the reach of science. The origin of species, all living things and all the varieties therein, and that's actually the title of Charles Darwin's famous book. But was any human present to observe the origin of the species? No. Can there be any scientific experiment designed to test the hypothesis of the origin of the universe or the origin of life? There's not. Can anybody experiment and demonstrate the repeatability of results concerning the origins of things? Those were one-time events that happened when no human was alive. We can't observe those things. We can't test those things. Certainly cannot repeat the results of any experiment thereon, because it can't be done in the first place. So when we're looking at science and the question of origins, how is it that there's so much attention paid in science to origins when it's beyond its realm? Scientists are the most closed-minded about the very questions that's outside of their realm. That might give us a clue, since they can't really perform science with those questions. They can be very closed-minded about it. So, of course, we have the warning from Scripture, 1 Timothy 6:20 and verse 21, which we've seen before, where he says, "O Timothy, keep that which is committed to thy trust, avoiding profane and vain babblings and oppositions of science, falsely so-called, which some professing have erred concerning the faith. Grace be with thee. Amen." So there are oppositions of science, falsely so-called. We have to avoid those. All right, so we haven't gotten to Darwin yet, because where Darwin begins, there's some things that come before that as far as origins. We've all heard of the Big Bang Theory. That's something else that we've all been taught. There's a little description, a basic description of it there in that cartoon. But and this does reflect, as Brother Jan was dealing with this topic recently in one of his presentations, what we have that exists now. It either had a beginning, or it's eternal and has always been. And of course, there's there's an enormous trap with either one of those that you choose. Because if you believe, if you reject God, and then you're going to claim you believe that material is eternal and has always existed, well, that flies in the face of all of the evidence, so much so that there are very few, if any, scientists that would argue that this universe has always existed. It's almost universally accepted that there was a definite beginning to the universe, and that also at some point it will have an end, consequently. But there is a pitfall with that if you reject God, because if it had a beginning, how did it begin? Well, again, that's really a question outside of the realm of science. But that doesn't stop them from trying, does it? And claiming that it's science. And here's where we end up with the Big Bang Theory. That's the most commonly presented scientific, so-called, argument for how the universe came to be. It was an explosion from a singularity, which refers to a single point of density, where it says where all known space was compressed into an infinitely small mass. Now, I have a problem with the wording of that, and if you think about terms, how can space be compressed into infinitely small mass? I mean, what is space? Space is nothing. What is mass? Something. So how can you compress nothing into something? That's really what you're left with. And then, of course, where did that original something, this mass, where did it come from? Of course, then they bring in their time frame there, where they talk about 12 to 15 billion years ago. The Big Bang Theory, space and mass, those aren't interchangeable terms. Those are contradictory things. Those are opposites. So you can't compress space into mass, for one thing. But when they say that there's this singular density of all mass, everything that's in the universe, all of the stars, planets, of course, Earth, everything in the universe, aside from the space between whatever the heavenly bodies are, all this mass. Imagine all of that. All of the galaxies and everything that we can see or know about, even with the strongest telescopes, to bring all of that into one single density of material. They're saying that all the mass in the entire universe started out as this compressed, dense amount of material. Of course, that would have to be incredibly dense, but where did all that come from? They start at that point. Who explains where all the mass of the universe, where it came from? And how did it explode? Well, that's what they say happened. So they just start from this existing mass that they will even concede isn't eternal. But they start with the Big Bang. They don't start with where the mass that banged came from. How did it get compressed into singularity? How did it explode? There's all these questions. And can they be answered scientifically? Of course not. Those are things that can't be observed, can't be tested. This is just a wild guess, and it's pretty wild. Is it really a scientific theory or is this imagination? It's really not a scientific theory. Now, I would offend many an astronomer with that statement, but astronomers, they observe what's out there in the universe. They observe the galaxies and stars and planets and all of that. Well, okay, we can look at things and we can learn some things, and there are things that can be observed about that and learned from, but you can't go back to where it started. There's no way to do that. So that is nothing but imagination and a guess about that. It's also interesting, some recent discoveries by, and actually this guy, Lior Shamir, is an engineer, so one of Jan's, somebody in his field, actually discovered this, had this published not even a year ago, Looking at, we're not going to get into the details of what redshift is from galaxies. But anyway, he made observations using the James Webb Space Telescope. Of course, he's going into imagination land there, but there's some quotes from what he published. He said, instead of showing an infant early universe, as astronomers expected, it showed large and mature galaxies. And then he also said, if the Big Bang happened, the scientists initially believed these galaxies are older than the universe itself. What that says for us that's useful is their own observations contradict their theory about what would be going on if there was a Big Bang. Now, there's a lot of loaded stuff in his conclusions there, too, because he's speaking about this large and mature galaxies. I mean, how can you tell whether it's mature? They have their theories, but we're going to get into that, too. But the age of galaxies, I mean, there's something else that there's guesswork in. But from our standpoint here, just take note that a lot of things that they're learning now completely contradict what would be predicted by the so-called Big Bang theory, to the point where there's some scientists that are abandoning that. They don't really have a useful framework. They haven't come up with another wild guess that's as good as from their viewpoint as the Big Bang theory. So we don't have a replacement yet, but they're starting to get very uncomfortable with the Big Bang theory, a lot of them, because of things that are being learned about it that don't fit. That doesn't mean they're going to come. That doesn't mean they're going to ever claim that God made it. But as we see these things, the fact is they don't have evidence from their own observations of what we can see now that will support their theory. All right, here's where we have apparent age versus actual age. So in Genesis chapter 1, verses 14 through 19, here he's describing the first Wednesday. Of Earth. Here we're on a Wednesday night. What did God do on this first Wednesday that was in Genesis 1? Well, God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth." And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also, and God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth, and to rule over the day and over the night, and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good, and the evening and the morning were the fourth day. How old are the stars? And how old is the sun and the moon? Which tells us, how old is the universe? I wish we had a few hours here tonight together, because then we could delve into that and look at what the scriptures say about it. But if we look at what God has said in his word, God tells us that these events occurred, and he's going day by day. We're not going to try to pick apart things like the day-age theory. There's some other things where, unfortunately, and this we'll have to get into in another one, maybe next week, but unfortunately, there's some Christians or so-called Christians that have tried to compromise with Darwinian evolution and they twist and turn the Bible to allow for the time that evolutionists demand, because for them, for everything to have evolved from one common ancestor, for all life to have evolved from one common ancestor, there are two big elements for that to be able to happen from their standpoint is time and chance. You would have to have a great deal of time for randomly, without any direction from any intelligent being, for everything to have evolved into its current form, all from one common ancestor. A one-celled organism, the first life. So they have to have all of that time to fit their theory. Do we have to allow them to have all of that time because to fit what God has said occurred? We do not. And God has told us how long it took him to make everything. How long did it take him to make the sun and the moon and the stars. It took him a Wednesday. He did it in a day. Do we believe that? He says so. And he does use the same word day there that he uses throughout the Old Testament. This is a 24-hour day. It's not a different day. It doesn't last because look at the last thing. And the evening and the morning was the fourth day. How do we define a day? When it's describing by the evening and the morning, does that sound like how we describe a day from its beginning to end? It's the same. These are 24-hour days. When we look at the biblical time, because it was 3 days later that he made Adam. Well, we know from the scriptures, you get to Genesis 5, and he tells us Adam lived 930 years, but he also tells us how old he was when he begat Seth, and then how old Seth was, tracing that genealogy from Adam all the way to Noah, and then Noah's sons. We're given a very precise definition of time, how each generation, how many years it took. No gaps. So there are things called the gap theory and the day-age theory where, unfortunately, some religious people try to accommodate evolution and come up with things that will allow for all of these millions or billions of years that God doesn't say it took. In fact, God says otherwise. You have to reject what God says to believe that. So it's not an innocent doctrine. It's not something that we could choose where it's no big deal. To choose any aspect of evolution or the time in which it takes, we have to reject what God says in His Word, which we can't do that. But here, from what we're looking at tonight, you can see that by God's statement, and He was the one that was there and did it, but He tells us He did that in one day, made the sun and the moon and the stars, all of that, did that in a day. So that tells us all of the galaxies. Are there young galaxies and old galaxies? Are there old, burned-out stars? And are there, I mean, do we see that from what God says? Or are the sun and the moon the same age as all the as the stars in the heavens? All the galaxies and everything. It's all the same age by what God says. All right? What is the closest star to the earth? Now, if I say it just like that, I hope some of you sharp ones back there would say the sun, because that would be the technically correct answer. All right, aside from the sun, what's the closest star to earth? Proxima Centauri, that's part of the Alpha Centauri system. It's 4.25 light years from earth. What does that mean? Well, that's how long it takes the light from that star to travel to Earth, 286,000 miles per second. Isn't that the speed of light? I didn't double check that before. Am I remembering that correctly? 186? Okay, I added a 2. 186,000 miles per second, that's speed of light. All right, so that's a lot of distance in 1 second. So you can think of that distance of the closest star besides the sun for that light, and it still takes over 4 years, 4.25 years for that light to travel at that speed to get here to us. So right now, the light that we're actually seeing from it that's meeting our eyes, when did that light that's now meeting our eyes, like if we were looked through a telescope tonight and looked at that star, the light that we're actually looking at, when did it that light emit from that star? A little over 4 years ago. There's some people in this building that weren't here at the time when that light left that star. Betelgeuse, I put this here because it's one of my favorite stars. So the constellation Orion, we can see that especially during the winter months. But it's that, and if you look at it, it is red looking. And that bottom picture, by the way, I took that picture with my cell phone in Death Valley on January the 2nd of this year. And you can see a little bit of a red color to Beetlejuice. I'm going to get my hand in front of the light right there. All right. And it does look, when you look at it in the sky, it has a red hue. You can see it. It's a red giant. It's a big star. Anyway, that is, it's a red supergiant, but it's 642. They're not exactly sure, but it's approximately 642 and a half. That seems like a precise number for an approximation. But anyway, 642 and a half light years from Earth. So if you're looking at when I was looking at the constellation there back in January and took that picture, that light I was looking at that moment, when did it leave the star Betelgeuse? That'd have been back in around 1382, which was less than 30 years after the Black Death Plague finished up in Europe that killed about half the population in the continent of Europe. You're talking going back to, that would still be within the time of the Middle Ages. So, that what we're looking at there, that's some pretty old light. Andromeda. That's the nearest galaxy to Earth. We're not including the Milky Way, the galaxy that we're in. But Andromeda, that galaxy is about 2.5 million light years from the Earth. So how can we see, and you can see that galaxy with the naked eye, but how can we see light from Andromeda that's 2.5 million years old? See, that's where scientists say, see, look, when they measure that, that means the universe is at least this old, and they can take look at some of these things and approximate the age, and you get millions and millions of years. So does that put us in a conundrum to explain that? Are we actually, in this case with Andromeda, when we look at it, are we looking at light? Did that light actually, that we're looking at, is it 2.5 million years old? Well, it can't be, because the universe is not that old. Again, when we take the scriptures and what it tells us about when God made things and the days that he took to make it, which he made Adam on the sixth day, we know exactly how we can add those years up by the generations that are recorded in the book of Genesis. And we know how old the earth is. It's a little over 6,000 years old, not 2.5 million years, or 12 billion or 15 billion, which some of them are now saying is on the young side. But it's none of that. So, can scientists really speak about galaxies or the universe in terms of their age? Well, it appears to be a certain age, but the age that something appears to be, does that necessarily mean it is that actual age, especially the first things that God made? That's right. It may not, that's right, it may not be there now. We may be seeing what was came from something that no longer exists. But here's a very easy way to prove this point. So how old did Adam and Eve look on the day they were made? They looked a lot different on their when they were one day old than we did. Didn't they? I mean, Adam and Eve, they were full-grown adults on their first day on the earth. So how old did they appear to be? They appeared to be adults that would have taken years to have reached their age, the age they were, but in actuality, so their apparent age was a lot older than their actual age, wasn't it? And that same concept is true of the earth and the universe. God made things with an apparent age that's greater than their actual age. Is that also true of the rocks on the earth? Yeah, so when and I have a little thing there, but geologists beware, we have to take into account apparent age. So God has made all these galaxies and stars in the heavens. Well, if he, and that's when he turned on the lights from those things, and if they're 2.5 million light years away and more for these galaxies, then how could no human could, we wouldn't be able, when we look up there, we would see nothing. Because they are actually, the light that they would have emitted, wouldn't be to us yet. Not even close. None of us by any generations countable generations from where we are now would be able to actually see that first light emitted by those things that far away. So God made them, put them in the heavens, but he also made the light appear to us now instantly. So it didn't come all the way from there in that short a time. God made it get here instantly for those things so we could even see them and know that they're there. So that's an interesting point, but it's very important. Because when the Big Bang Theory and all of these things that ignores that principle. So science cannot explain the origin of the universe, and it cannot explain the origin of life. That's beyond the realm of science. But getting to Darwinian evolution, it is the alternative to creationism. So if you reject that God created the heavens and the earth and everything in it, which is the truth, but if someone rejects that truth, they're stuck with evolution. There's no other way to explain all the variety of living things that exist. So Darwin is the one that fathered that explanation that is believed by every atheist. But it's not supported by the evidence. So Charles Darwin lived from 1809 to 1882. He studied at Cambridge University from 1828 to 1831. Mentioned his time when he was 22 years old. He set sail on His Majesty's ship Beagle that went all the way around the world in about 5 years, and he was on that as a naturalist and geologist. So he observed a lot of fossils and a lot of living creatures in places all the way around the world during that particular voyage, which that's where he was formulating his theories that he ended up producing in his very famous book that is On the Origin of Species. The full name of it is On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, published in 1859. And that book theorizes that all species of life evolved from a common ancestor through the process of natural selection. Natural selection, it was somebody else shortly after the publication of the book that described Darwin's theory of natural selection as survival of the fittest. And actually Darwin preferred that term and adopted it himself to more accurately describe what he was postulating. But that's the idea that traits that different living things have evolve that improve their ability to reproduce and survive, and they will be selected by nature, so natural selection, for passing on to future generations. So if you evolve some characteristic or trait that helps you to survive and produce more offspring, then that particular trait is going to tend to be passed on to other generations and therefore will be captured in the future generations. And so over time then, these traits or different changes by that, he says, everything that we see today, all living things evolved and came from one common ancestor, which would be a one-celled, the first life, which would be some one-celled organism, although Darwin didn't know anything about cells in his time. That had not, there were some ideas about it. He had his own ideas, but which were wrong. But anyway, that's his basic theory. He made these drawings of some finches on the Galapagos Islands, and he saw some of their different beaks that would help different species of these finches to eat different types of food. Of course, when we look at that, they might have their beaks might be shaped a little differently. But what are they all? What do they have in common? They're all birds, and they're all finches. So they're not just a bird. I mean, they are, but they're even within a particular type of bird. So there's varieties of finches. Shocking, isn't that? Just like we have varieties of us. I mean, we don't all look the same. There are varieties of everything, which we'll need to recognize about species and kinds, which we want to look at here in a moment. But Darwinian evolution, it contradicts the Bible because the scriptures teach how God made everything after his kind. It did not evolve from a common ancestor. We've all seen these kinds of things and the monkey to man business. None of that happened. He drew it, and other people have drawn it, but it's just drawings. It never happened. It's imagination. Biblical kinds. Genesis 1, 11 to 13. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass, and the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself. This is how God defines all the living things he made. He made them by, and that word kind, it's a word that describes a type. But every kind has its seed within itself after his kind. And so it reproduces accordingly. And God saw that it was good, and the evening and the morning were the third day. So that was the Tuesday. And then we have Genesis 1, 21 through 27 with all of these living things. And look at the statement over and over again about them. And God created whales and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind. And every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas and let fowl multiply in the earth. And the evening and the morning were the fifth day. And God said, let the earth bring forth a living creature after his kind, cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth after his kind. And it was so. Over and over again, after his kind, the seed was in itself, after his kind. Does that allow for evolution from one kind to another? Or did God make each kind distinctly? And then each of those kinds that he made then to multiply itself with the seed of that kind in itself? That's what God says. Everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let us make man in our image. Now, this is how man originated, in total contradiction to that lousy cartoon that we looked at where we see that monkey and all those so-called stages until it evolved into us. That's not what God says. God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. Even that last statement is in dispute these days. But here we read the facts. But God made man as a distinct kind. It was the end of the creation. It was the crown of his creation when he made us in his image. We didn't evolve from anything. We were created by God in the image of God. And that's where we came from. These pictures coming up here. This one I took 4 years ago when we were at the Creation Museum that's up in Kentucky. Interesting place, but there's a display of these different animal kinds. There's much variation within a biblical kind. And if you look up the definition of kind, it's a sort. So there's a different sort of beings, living things. And there's a lot of variation within that. Evolution, which is the word, what is the word evolution? What would be a definition of the word evolution by itself? Just leave Darwin out of it for a moment. Just the word evolution, what does it mean? Change. Is there change? Does change occur in nature? Absolutely. So, are we against the idea of change occurring in nature? No. But that change occurs within certain boundaries. And when it comes to living things, that evolution occurs within a kind. And that's expected. And that's where you get the variety of finch beaks. There's no problem with that. There's much evidence for that kind of evolution. And we accept all of that evidence. That doesn't contradict what God says about the kinds that he has made. It supports it. But evolution from one kind to another kind does not happen. There's zero evidence for Darwinian evolution. And this is from another one of those diagrams, just demonstrating the variety within the dog kind. When God made that kind, what we call a dog, about 35 of current species of animals today fall within that kind, including foxes, wolves, jackals, coyotes, the wild dingoes in Australia, and the wild African dogs, domestic dogs. I mean, there's a huge variety within the dog kind, which is another thing, because when people say, well, there's no way all the animals, you could fit all the animals in the ark. Well, it doesn't say that God fit two of every kind of man-made or man-described species in there, but all there was two of every kind, and there's a lot of variety within a kind. So was there room in the ark for two of every kind and seven of some? Yes, most definitely. All right, biological species, is that the same as a biblical kind or different? These things you'll learn if you end up in biology classes at some point. And this is called taxonomy. That's the man-made classification system of living things. But a biological species is not the same as a biblical kind. All right, Darwin came out with all of this. And by the way, if you recognize the bottom right corner, for those of you who know Brian and Melina Chadwick, that was them back in 1997, January the 28th, 1997. That's when I took those pictures. We were over in Cambridge, England. And who was it that studied at Cambridge, England from 1828 to 1831? That's a pop quiz from about five slides ago or eight slides ago. Charles Darwin, that's where he studied, there at Cambridge University. One of his professors, a geologist, was named Adam Sedgwick. He taught him in 1831, and they remained friends thereafter. There's a historical museum at Cambridge University, and so the Chadwicks took us to that. And I was very amazed to find that's a copy of, the picture's kind of blurry looking, but anyway, that's a copy of The Origin of Species by Darwin. He sent a copy of that when he, or maybe the manuscript when he came up with it, sent it to his old professor, Adam Sedgwick. And that's a quote of Sedgwick of what he said, wrote a letter to Charles Darwin, basically critiquing his book. I'll read it here, because this is classic mid-19th century British skewer job here. He says, "If I did not think you a good-tempered and truth-loving man, I should tell you that I've read your book with more pain than pleasure. Parts of it I admired greatly, parts I laughed at till my sides were almost sore. Other parts I read with absolute sorrow, because I think them utterly false and grievously mischievous. You have deserted, after a start in that tram road of all solid physical truth, the true method of induction, and started up a machinery as wild, I think, as Bishop Wilkins's locomotive that was to sail with us to the moon. In spite of our disagreement on some points of the deepest moral interest, your true-hearted old friend, A. Sedgwick." But that was what that quote was. I was actually shocked to see that was in the museum, that quote at Cambridge University. I guess since he was a professor at Cambridge, too, they couldn't disavow him entirely. But anyway, that was kind of interesting. But that's what one of his contemporaries, one of his own teachers, said about his book when he read it. So when he published that, he was not instantly revered by all and his theory accepted by everybody. There were some scientists that read that and recognized it for what it was at the very time in which it was published. And there was a whole lot that Darwin didn't know at the time when he published that book, such as understanding that the cell is the most basic unit of life, and that all cells arise from pre-existing cells. He had no idea about that. He proposed the existence of something he referred to as gimules, that were, quote, tiny particles of inheritance.
There's no such thing. That was something he came up with as an idea. Totally wrong. He didn't know anything about atoms, atomic particles, the subatomic particles, chemical elements, molecules, therefore biochemistry and all that stuff. He knew nothing about that. Knew nothing about DNA or genetics. So that meant he knew nothing of what the mechanics would actually have to be in order for his theory of evolution of all living things from a common ancestor, for that to have happened, it would involve all these things that he knew nothing about. All he really knew is he could observe the big picture, and he could see, well, this looks similar to that there, and then he concluded, well, it must have come from that. Well, we all share the same environment, this earth. God made us all to live in the same place. Now, how many creatures that live on land have lungs or heart and blood? I mean, that's common to all things that are on the earth. And what about gills and fish? I mean, we have to breathe. God made that so. There's common design to all the things that God made that have to live in this common, on this common earth. So should we be shocked that God would use some similarity of designs and things that would enable the creatures he made to live here in the earth that he made and breathe the atmosphere that he created or what's in the waters that he created? I mean, we would expect that. It does not in any way indicate that one came from the other, though. This will make Hannah feel great, but these are all the biochemical pathways in the body, or someone's attempt to fit that on a single slide, and you can't read any of the detail. There's too much there. I mean, it would be, for that to actually be legible to us, we'd have to have a huge board that would take up pretty much all the front of the auditorium here. But look at the complexity there. Darwin knew nothing of that, absolutely nothing of any of that. How could he have known about all those biochemical pathways that are involved in metabolism and living things? Well, he couldn't. Would he have proposed that all of that evolved if he'd known about it? It's kind of an interesting question. We'll never know. But people now should know better. Does that look like some accident that happened by time and chance over millions of years? Or does that look like something that was designed by an eternally powerful creator? I mean, just look at the detail there, and you can't even read it. There's a zoomed-in look at just one little piece of that slide. Doesn't help much either, does it? I mean, it just really shows the complexity of all that's in biochemical pathways. All that going on within each and every cell of our body. I mean, it's incredible. These are some slides. I showed those to you before in the introduction to Christian Evidences, going back to when I started college. And as I said, I majored in biology, so that's what my bachelor's degree is in. So when I started in the fall of 1985, hard to believe it's coming up 40 years ago, and that's actually the classroom. That was the building back there, and that's the actual classroom where I had my first biology class in the Coker Life Sciences building. Yes, the building hasn't crumbled yet. But Dr. Anthony Huang, he was the first biology teacher that I had there, first biology professor. He came in on the first day, and that room holds 180 people, that auditorium, something, or you know, at least 150 or more people. It was packed. And he came in, he had a lectern there, kind of like this, but he put his book down on it with a big bang. And then he started, his opening statement was, evolution is not a theory, it is a fact. I mean, that's how the opening words of the first biology lecture I had in college. And then he started with the Big Bang, so-called, and how the theory about how all the heavenly bodies came to be, and then how the mass cooled and formed the earth, and then the atmosphere of the earth, and how it eventually was able to, with electricity and the certain atmosphere at a particular time, how you got amino acids and the first proteins, and then those proteins somehow organized themselves into the first cell that became alive somehow, and then evolved and went through all the details. Spent the whole lecture, over an hour, then going, taking off from the first cell to all the different living things and how they all evolved from that common ancestor up to man. And then he concluded that at the end. He says the only missing link, which isn't true, but he said the only missing link is how the non-living became the living. And I had this slide in before, too. That's not a missing link. That's a missing chain. How can you just skip over that and just say, we can't explain how life came to be, but believe all this other stuff we're saying? I mean, that's leaving out really the most important thing, isn't it? I have a letter here. This was a few weeks after I started this. And so this is a letter my dad wrote me October the 4th, 1985. So I took some pictures of the original I have right there. So I still have that letter he wrote me. So I was very unhappy with all this evolution I was being taught. Hated it. And so he said, I hope things are settling down with Dr. Huang. They hadn't. But he says, in all of your biology, biochemistry, and geology, if you take any. I did skip geology. But anyway, he said, those courses, you will get evolution out of the ears. After many repetitions from the, quote, knowledgeable faculty, it may begin to sound plausible as Hitler or Himmler or Goebbels, one of those guys. And if you repeat a lie often enough, people will begin to believe it. There are lots of good arguments against the idea, of course, but they are very closed-minded. Amazingly so for people masquerading as scientists with open questioning minds. I have discussed and argued it with my faculty friends, but to no avail. They are unshakable and totally blind. Fortunately, I guess they say the same thing about me. Take care and study hard. Love, Dad. So that's what he had to say 40 years ago. He had a PhD in organic chemistry, so he had all of that that he had been immersed in himself. So he still had his faith intact, but this is the conclusion of the presentation this evening. But I had that at the end because this is the importance of what we're trying to do here, because all of our children are going to be taught it. Hopefully not the degree, to the extent that I was. I wouldn't recommend anybody majoring in that, but we're going to be taught it, everybody, every one of us. We're going to be challenged with these things, so we need to be aware of it, but most importantly, we need to have the defense. If we can teach our children how to maintain their faith in God, which is what the object of this is, for us to know and to be able to help our children and grandchildren, we need to teach our children what God says and the defense against these attacks on our faith that the devil's going to bring. So hopefully we'll be able to continue on with that and do much more of that in these coming weeks through this study. But got a lot more to look at, but that's a little overview of Darwinian evolution. I think, Brother Jan, you have our song leader tonight. Brother Peter, you have our closing prayer. And we want to make a few announcements before we close.